This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 20th of January 2010 on Monocle 24.
Hello and a very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up on today's programme, we'll be talking to Rio's finance minister about drumming up investment for her city.
That's why I came here, to personally invite institutional investors to go, to fly down to Rio and attend the conference.
We'll also be talking quality watches at Geneva's Watch Fair.
Swiss is all about, you know, mastering and to have the know-how on how to create, design, produce and assemble these watches.
I'll be joined in the studio by the author Mihir Bose, who'll be explaining why sport has changed the world. And why are most people being priced out of the wine market? We talked to an expert about the demise of the quaffable bottle. All that, plus we'll meet the neighbours and get another check-in from Paris Fashion Week. That's right here on Midori House on Monocle 24. So plenty to be getting on with in the next 60 minutes. First of all, though, let's get the latest news from around the world with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. Amateur footage filmed by a passenger on the Costa Concordia has shown that crew members were giving contradictory information after the ship hit rocks off the Italian island of Giglio. As passengers waited for instructions, they first heard an announcement from one crew member directing them to a lifeboat.
Tango India, lifeboat number 3.
Moments later, another crew member told passengers to go back to their cabins. The Italian broadcaster Rai said the footage had been recorded some 40 minutes after the vessel hit rocks. 11 people are known to have died when the ship ran aground, with a further 24 unaccounted for. France has threatened to pull out from its activities in Afghanistan after a rogue Afghan soldier opened fire on French soldiers, killing 4 and wounding around 15 others. The killings in the Taghab Valley of Afghanistan's eastern Kapisa province are the latest in a series of incidents that have seen Afghan troops turn on Western allies. French President Nicolas Sarkozy said all French operations on the ground were being suspended, and his defence minister was dispatched to clarify the situation in Afghanistan. Finnish voters look set to elect veteran conservative Sauli Niinisto as their next president. The former finance minister from the National Coalition Party is favourite for the election on Sunday. The Eurosceptic Finns Party, under leader Timo Soini, which opposes EU bailouts, is trailing third or even fourth place, according to some polls. Niinisto is calling on Finland to unite in the face of the economic downturn.
The president has also an important role as leading opinions and attitudes. And what I would like to see is very good social cohesion in Finland, taking notice to the fact that we are facing a bit difficult economic times.
Results from Europe's police forces revealed that more than 1 million motorists were breath tested in the space of 7 days during an annual crackdown on drink drivers across 28 countries. During the operation coordinated by TISPOL, the European Traffic Police Network, more than 13,500 drivers failed breath tests. TISPOL President Pasi Kemppainen said the cooperation of a record number of European countries in this action was a firm endorsement of how seriously police take the issues of drink and drug driving. Researchers studying a potentially deadlier airborne version of the H5N1 influenza virus, or bird flu, have voluntarily suspended their research for 60 days. The scientists from Erasmus Medical College in the Netherlands and 2 universities in the USA defended their research as crucial to public health efforts, but bowing to public concerns, they said there was widespread fear that the mutant viruses may escape from the laboratories and be used to create a devastating form of bioterrorism. Those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
James, thank you very much indeed. Time to get the weather now with Thomas Schaffernecker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
In Europe, the end of the business week brings Atlantic weather fronts, and with that, cloud and rain to many cities in France, Germany and Denmark, snow for the Alps and across Eastern Europe. Rainy skies also across the eastern Mediterranean, so Greece, western Turkey and Cyprus. And Saturday and Sunday will bring further rain and snow in Europe. Here's your weekend city outlook. In London, 10 degrees with sun and showers. In Zurich, 7 Celsius and rain. Bordeaux, 13 degrees, also sun and showers. Copenhagen, 3 Celsius with a rain and snow mix. Over to North America now. On the Atlantic seaboard, fine Friday weather in Washington, D.C. Some sunshine here. But that's about to change. Saturday will bring rain and possibly a little snow upstate New York and across parts of New England. The Pacific side of the United States continues to be battered by rain and wind. Northern and Central California will be getting the poor weather over the weekend too. On to the weekend city outlook. In San Francisco, 13 Celsius and rain. Denver, mild, 10 degrees and sunny. New York City, 1 Celsius with a rain and snow mix. In Miami, 26 degrees and mostly sunny. Other world destinations for the next 2 or 3 days. Let's take a look at South America. Saturday and Sunday, hot and humid in Buenos Aires, highs up to 33 degrees. In Sao Paulo, a chance of thunder showers, not as hot here, around 25 degrees. And changeable weather for Cape Town, plenty of sun, but showers at times too. That's all. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
6 minutes past the hour here on Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And Monocle 24 highlight, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ei oo koko.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propojala version.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
The city of Rio de Janeiro has been drumming up support from potential investors in London today. In May, the city will host its annual Investors Day, which is in fact 2 days long, and it'll cover everything from oil and gas to banking and transport. The city's new finance minister, Eduarda Lahoque, has been travelling around Europe to invite people to the event. She dropped by at Midori House to say hello and explain where the city of Rio is at financially.
Especially I came to invite investors, institutional investors, to attend a conference that's going to take place in Rio next May, 21st and 22nd, Rio Investors Day. It's a CEO conference that we organized for the very first time last year, and it was a huge success. But at that time, we didn't get so many foreigners as we would like to. So that's why I came here, to personally invite institutional investors to fly down to Rio and attend the conference.
And what was their reaction?
I would say that most of them said yes, and I hope to have them there.
What are you trying to get them to invest in Rio?
Yeah, it's an opportunity to show all the projects that we have been doing for the Olympic Games, infrastructure projects, but also it's a CEO conference for public traded companies, Brazilian companies, that will have the opportunity to show their projects. And so it's an portfolio managers event, something like that.
And it wasn't just London that you were visiting. What has been the reaction throughout Europe, where you've also travelled to?
Yeah, very good. I have been before to Amsterdam and also to Paris in order to invite institutional investors there to fly down to Rio as well.
Now, we know that the British Foreign Secretary is currently in Rio de Janeiro at the moment trying to, catch up, is the way that people have been describing it. Why do you think people have taken so long to realise that Brazil is a place to invest in? Because your economy has been growing for some time now.
Yeah, good question. I don't know, I think, exactly, but I think that we should announce loudly what we have been doing. And it's something that I came here also to do, to show the investors everything that we have been doing in Rio in terms of public management. So the city of Rio has nowadays the same rate, credit rating, than the federal government.
Brazil's interest rate has dropped and you are just about to go into negative growth for the first time. Do you think that Brazil has grown too fast, too quickly?
Yeah, well, we do have some bottlenecks, but we are trying to address all of them. And especially in the city of Rio, we have been investing a lot in infrastructure projects. So to give you an idea, in the first year of our term, that it was in 2009, we had a budget for investment of only less than 500 million to invest in infrastructure projects. And now, last year, we got an investment capacity of $2.8 billion. That means multiplying by almost six our investment capacity.
And what are you investing in Rio?
Transportation, sanitation, housing, so all infrastructure projects.
One of the images that Rio still projects, rightly or wrongly, is of a city divided into two, the beach high life and the extreme poverty and gangs of the favelas. And it is an image that it is having trouble shaking off. What would you say to that?
Well, I think that we are finally in the moment of finishing this part. How should I say? Cidade Partida. There is a book. Anyway, change. I will begin
a divided again. City.
Hmm?
A city
divided,
in two.
Yeah, no, because there is a book by Zuenir Ventura, very good, talking exactly about this, the divided city. So, yeah, we have been trying to break this paradigm, and I think that we have been very successful in this politics. I think that the security policy of the governor, Sérgio Cabral, is a tremendous success. And now at the city hall level, we have been investing a lot in what we call social UPPs. The UPPs are the pacified units of the police. But as Beltrami, the secretary of security of the state government, always says, after installing the police, we have to provide public service, because otherwise the traffic dealers will come back.
So what you have to do is pacify a favela, possibly by force, and then you step in.
Yes, exactly. And in fact, we have been entering the city hall level through IPP, an institute there, enters together with the police, in order to provide public services and also try to offer economic opportunities for. So we have been working together with the NGOs in order to create economic opportunities for people of the favelas. So it's something very important. We cannot leave the traffic dealers to come back.
When you talk about influence and help by the NGOs, what other things are you doing to encourage small businesses to grow and to make Rio succeed?
Well, we have been trying to improve a lot our business environment. And we have created, inspired in Think London, we have created our own investment promoting agency, Rio Negócios, Rio Business. And I would say to people to, can I say the website? Their website is www.rionegocios.com. And then you will see, and then this agency tries to not only to attract investment, but also to facilitate the investors to get the license and all this stuff.
That was Eduardo Lahocchia, who's the finance secretary for the city of Rio. Time now on Midori House for some music, and we'll stay in Brazil. This is Ave Cruz by Seio. And that was Ave Cruz by Seio, the choice of our Brazilian researcher, Fernando. This is Midori House. It's 17 minutes past the hour.
For listeners in Tokyo or visitors to Japan, you can now enjoy a coffee, a Wilkinson dry ginger ale, or our classic curry at our first ever Monocle Cafe and Shop at the new Hank Hugh Men's Department Store, just steps from Ginza and the lobby of the Peninsula. Featuring a Monocle shop, stocked with our ever-expanding collection of special collaborations, the Monocle Cafe is the perfect place to refuel after a run round the Imperial Palace or a busy day in Marinucci. For more details, visit monocle.com.
Culture with me, Robert Bound, will make you feel like you've seen, heard, watched, attended and danced to the finest and most exciting events in the world's cultural calendar.
They're like metal, glam, monster band.
They've literally just put some names of pop groups in a bag and shook it.
What is this fantastic place where all these bands still exist?
That's Culture with me, Robert Bound, available all week. Find us at monocle.com or iTunes, download our app and listen on your phone, or just stay tuned to Monocle 24. Thanks for tuning in.
This week saw the exclusive Salon International de la Haute Horlogerie, otherwise known as the annual SIHH watch fair, taking place in Geneva. It's a private event that attracts some of the finest watchmakers in the world and sees them sharing their latest designs with fellow professionals and also some lucky journalists. Our man Ivan Carvalho was there. He sent us this report.
At Geneva's annual Salon International de la Haute Horlogerie, Switzerland's luxury watchmakers had plenty of reason to break out the champagne. While visitors were wined and dined, a select group of 18 watch brands, many part of luxury group Richemont, were in good spirits after a week filling order books for timepieces that carried that all-important Swiss-made label. Alain Zimmermann, CEO of Baume & Mercier, had this to say.
For us, it's key because it's in our DNA. And if you just look at the logo, it's written Baume & Mercier, Maison d'Horlogerie, Geneva, 1830. And clearly, you know, Swissness stands for seriousness. It stands for tradition. And we're celebrating, or let's say we're having 182 years of history, tradition, heritage in watchmaking. And I think Swiss is all about, you know, mastering and to have the know-how on how to create, design, produce and assemble these watches. It's clearly like a seal for quality. And as far as we're concerned, quality is key in our DNA.
That Swiss craftsmanship doesn't come cheap, of course. But the crowd in Geneva were happily lining up to see brands' latest novelties, many of which carried five-figure price tags.
Could I see your latest Tourbillon models?
Yes, with pleasure. Would you like to see a model in red gold, or maybe another one in titanium?
Despite news of the EU debt crisis outside the exhibition hall, inside, retailers like Dennis Ash, owner of Geneva's Leur Ash, were upbeat.
From what I see, from what I feel, I think the high-end pieces, the luxury pieces, is not suffering because there is always good market for high-end pieces. I think it's suffering more in Europe, France or Switzerland, but China and India, they don't talk about crisis.
With double-digit sales growth coming from developing nations, brands look to court those countries' consumers, particularly those in China. Louis Nardin, editor-in-chief of World Tempest.
This is the Water Dragon year in China. It will start on the 23rd of January, and you had so many dragons in this fair. It was amazing. And as the dragon is the strongest sign in the Chinese astrological calendar, they had made a lot of efforts to produce great dials or even sculptures on clocks, like at Parmigiani, who has a huge dragon, respecting all the aesthetic and also in terms of materials, stones and metals, the codes of the dragon, the real dragon. So if you want to a good approach of the dragon in watchmaking, you have to go here, or you should have come to go and travel here in the fair.
And with watch lovers eager to buy, business was brisk. Established brands like 250-year-old Vacheron Constantin sold out their collection. And for newcomers to Haute Horlogerie, the sky was the limit. independent watchmaker Richard Mill.
It has been unbelievable. I'm always optimistic because there are no reasons why not to be successful. But I wasn't expecting that to come so quickly, because after the first day of the fair, many of the models were already sold, and now start the problems of production.
And some of these models are quite expensive timepieces.
Yeah. We have, for example, a sapphire transparent model, which is absolutely unbelievable. It's when you see it's a shock. It's technically a monster, and aesthetically it's a marvel. So and public price is around, let's say, if you say in US dollar, $1.8 million, and the first day everything was sold.
And that was the watchmaker Richard Mille, ending our report there from Ivan Carvalho at the SIHH Watch Fair in Geneva. Well, Ivan has not been the only man from Monocle who's been on the road this week. Yesterday, we heard from Aisha Spears at Paris Fashion Week. She's putting her feet up for a couple of hours, because earlier today I caught up with our associate business editor, Jonathan Openshaw. He's also been checking out the latest designs in the French capital this week.
It has been, extremely busy. Like you said, we've had a couple of shows. It's the first day of the trade shows as well. So we got a bit of a sneak preview of Capsule, and we saw the first day of Trenoy. Appointments, and it's been great.
How was Trenoy? Let's start off with them.
Okay, so Trenoy is an interesting, it's a real mixed bag for us. I mean, there's things that Monocle's never really going to cover. There's lots of kind of shark tooth necklaces and accessories and slightly weird distressed leather and denim and type vibes. I mean, very, very eclectic European mix. But there's old brands that we're very familiar with, old favourites like Howling by Morrison, which is an incredible kind of knitwear brand that features quite a lot of Norwegian Rain, which is an Oslo-based kind of outerwear brand that uses these brilliant Japanese technical fabrics. So a couple of nice things to pick out. Aisha and I were going around today and we found a nice feature that we might do for tomorrow, which is on couples in fashion. So there was this one brand being called Chauncey, which is based in Brussels, which again is this beautiful knitwear brand. We spoke to the woman there, she's been a designer for everyone from Hermes to Jean-Paul Gaultier, and so we're going to interview her and her husband tomorrow, and then also Linda Farrow, the sunglasses we featured before, ran by a couple called Simon and Tracy. So we can do a bit of a couples in fashion vibe, which might be interesting.
So what has been the general feeling of what's been the sort of the overriding themes this week in terms of design and trends?
Well, I think, I mean, probably Aisha touched on it a bit yesterday when she was talking to you, but we've seen on the catwalk certainly a real return to great tailoring. So it was YSL today, and a very leather-heavy collection from them, kind of, you know, blazers with leather lapels, leather trousers. So if you're not in the market for leather, Emma, you're going to steer clear of YSL. But beautiful, beautiful silhouettes, great tailoring, really classic. And it's what we saw at Louis Vuitton yesterday. It's what we saw in Milan at, you know, everyone from Prada to Zegna. So there is this real return in menswear to something, you know, the real core competency, and this idea that, you know, the chap is now looking for real solid, beautiful tailoring. So that was nice to see.
And what was the reaction to this resurgence of tailoring?
Well, I think it's been picked up in the press as a kind of, you know, when the market's uncertain, people want to go back to something that they see as a real investment, a real quality. And I think it's slightly, maybe a lot of the kind of excess has been cut out of the market, and now we're returning to things, beautiful materials, you know, beautiful silhouettes, quite a kind of classic resurgence. That's definitely was the trend we picked up in Milan. It seems to be carrying through in Paris as well.
We've just caught you coming out of the Comme des Garçons show. How did that go?
Yes, well, actually, you know what? It's my first Comme show that I've been to. And huge fan of Ray Karakuba and the kind of theatre of it all. So this was, so leave classic tailoring behind, because now we're talking about bonnets, we're talking about kilts, we're talking about, you know, really, you know, elaborate kind of embroidery, and there was quite vivid rose patterning going on. All the models were wearing quite strange wigs that seemed to be based on a kind of Ronnie Wood type vibe, so real kind of chopped in mullets. And they were doing what I think in the business would be called a technical walk, which involves, so instead of just having to walk straight and turn right, they were kind of stopping and sauntering around. So it's very much the kind of theatre that Ray is so well known for. And, yeah, a really beautiful show.
And not to wish sounding too flippant, but will you be channeling Ronnie Wood?
I will not be channeling Ronnie Wood. I think I'm going to leave that to the 6'5" beautiful models, and I'm going to stick with my slightly more toned-down look.
So finally, what's up for you next? Where next?
Okay, well, the big thing tomorrow is the opening of Capsule, and we stopped by today actually to get a sneak preview. So we spoke to the organisers, Minya and Chris, and so we actually recorded an interview with them, which has lots of crashing and bashing because they were literally scaffolding was being put up around our ears. But that's great. I mean, they've done amazingly, Capsule, and they now have, you know, Las Vegas, New York, Berlin, Paris. They only started, I can't remember how many years ago, but I mean, they've really made their mark. And so yeah, that'll be opening tomorrow, and that they have a brilliant selection of brands that are very spot on for us. So we'll definitely be going by to check that one out.
And that was Jonathan Openshaw talking to me earlier about this week's Paris Fashion Week. Coming up in the next half hour, we'll be visiting the slopes of the Burgundy wine region. But first, here's the news with James Luckhurst. James.
Amateur footage filmed by a passenger on the Costa Concordia has shown that crew members were giving contradictory information after the ship hit rocks off the Italian island of Giglio. As passengers waited for instructions, they first heard an announcement from one crew member directing them to a lifeboat. Moments later, another crew member told passengers to go back to their cabins. The Italian broadcaster Rai said the footage had been recorded some 40 minutes after the vessel hit rocks. 11 people are known to have died when the ship ran aground, with a further 24 unaccounted for. France has threatened to pull out from its activities in Afghanistan after a rogue Afghan soldier opened fire on French soldiers, killing 4 and wounding around 15 others. The killings in the Taghab Valley of Afghanistan's eastern Kapisa province are the latest in a series of incidents that have seen Afghan troops turn on Western allies. Finnish voters look set to elect veteran Conservative Sauli Niinisto as their next president. The former finance minister from the National Coalition Party is favourite for the election on Sunday. Europe's safety regulator has ordered urgent inspections on almost a third of the Airbus A380 fleet after cracks were found inside the wings of the world's largest jetliner. No aircraft have been grounded, but the most heavily used aircraft must be examined within 4 days, according to authorities. And researchers studying a potentially deadlier airborne version of the H5N1 influenza virus, or bird flu, have voluntarily suspended their research for 60 days. The scientists from Erasmus Medical College in the Netherlands and 2 universities in the USA defended their research as crucial to public health efforts to detect when the bird flu virus might change in the wild in a way that could spark a pandemic. But bowing to public concerns, they said there was widespread fear that the mutant viruses may escape from the laboratories and be used to create a devastating form of bioterrorism. Those are the stories at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, James. And James will be back in a little under half an hour with a full update of the world news. Now we turn to wine now, Burgundy in particular. Burgundy's been accused and praised in equal measure for being arguably the most complicated wine-producing region in the world. Tiny patches of land combined with a labyrinthine labelling system make buying a bottle of Burgundy an almost intellectual pursuit. The 2010 vintage has been heralded as a work of pure alchemy. Perfect weather has contributed to what are many saying is a perfect vintage. But the 2010 vintage is also being described as the last one that could be affordable to many people. To explain this, I'm joined by the wine merchant for the independent retailer The Sampler, Sébastien Crozetier. A very warm welcome, Sébastien, to Midori House. Explain to us then why the 2010 vintage is so exciting.
Well, hi, I'm really, Well, 2010 is simply, I mean, it's simply a very good vintage year for, I mean, people who've drank Burgundy in the, I mean, in previous years. And if you compare it with 2009, which was more of a, which was a warmer vintage, in fact. And and it was easier to understand in comparison with 2010. 2010's got the acidity right. It's got the because the acidity will keep it for a long time. I mean, the weather was great. Also, the only problem is that the crops are low. So 30 to 50%, the yields were down 30 to 50%, and therefore there's not much. The demand is really high, but there's not much wine available around.
So is that what's pushing the prices up? Because, like you said, we had the 2009 vintage, which was brilliant, and the 2008 vintage, which was great, and then the 2005 vintage, which everybody said was immaculate. Why is the 2010 vintage being described as the last one that many of us will be able to afford?
Well, it's just simply because, demand has risen from various other places, and normally Burgundy places that used to be in, the general market here. And there's a higher demand, and but the demand is really high on the, especially for the top class wines for the top domain. So demand is really high for the Grand Crus and the some of those domains who produce fantastic wines. So I sort of agree with you when you say it's the last affordable vintage, but sort of, because there's plenty of small growers. Yeah, which are not yet known, which produce fabulous wines, and the wine is very affordable. So surely if you go for the top domains, the top crus, that will always be more expensive, especially because the quantities made per year are not high. And if you compare it with Bordeaux, which is 200,000 bottles, one of the growers in Burgundy may only have 0.6 or 0.7 hectares in the Grand Cru. So therefore, it only produces 2 or 3 casks of the Grand Cru, for example, the Bonnemar. And then, the price will always rise, especially because now there's more demand for it than ever.
This has been one of the things, though, that many people have said, that Bordeaux has always been accused of being the area where a good name determines the price. So you get a Petrus, which you always know is going to cost an absolute fortune, regardless of the vintage. Arguably, with Burgundy, it's always been a tiny little bit more fun, because although you have the Grand Cru, such as, the Cheval Blanc, whatever, because Burgundy is packaged up into such tiny little areas of wine producing sort of fields almost, you can actually have a little bit more fun trying to find a really good wine that doesn't cost a fortune. So why are people saying this is the last time we can afford a good Burgundy?
Well, no, I think that it's just because there's more people who really want, there's more people who want to invest in Burgundy, whereas before, people who would buy, in general, people who would buy Burgundy, especially the top ones, they normally drink these wines. But nowadays, there's more people who want to buy it in order to invest, and therefore, the prices will go up.
This is a problem, arguably, that's been in existence for quite a long time, though, that the, as recently as 10, 15 years ago, there used to be wine buyers from whom the domestic purchaser could occasionally get a really, really good bottle of wine. The domestic purchaser been pretty much taken out of the equation by the fact that big businesses and investors are now just going in and snapping up all the amazing vintages before it even gets anywhere near a market?
Pardon, say again? I can't really hear you.
Do the high-level investors go in now immediately and buy the great vintages? As has been the situation for many, many years, people who might want to buy just one or two bottles to drink don't stand a chance.
That's true, and that's the sad part. But in order to buy a few bottles of those top crus, you have to be tied up on an allocation, and you have to get cases and other cases of that. Therefore, for the new, anyone else who wants to try one of these, and you have to fork out a lot of money if you buy it at a wine merchant, or you just can't. But then saying that, there's so many interesting, and like you said, it's an intriguing place because you have to search for your wine, and you have to look at it, and you have to find, you can find some great, just Bourgogne Rouge, some fantastic wine. There's a lot of which are not great, but there's some fantastic one out there. So it makes it very exciting. I think it's a great place, Burgundy, in that way, because you really have to put more effort. But sadly, there's a price on Burgundy wines in general, Pinot Noir, they're more expensive. So sometimes not many people want to take the gamble. So
as an independent retailer, how do you strike that balance between taking a gamble with a wine that you think might be good and buying a wine that you know that will sell?
Obviously we taste the wines before, and in order to sell some wine, we need to taste the wines. We don't just buy it. I mean, sometimes you do buy it because of the names, but most of the time it's just because we went there, we tasted it, and we thought that it brings good value and a great wine, and we think that people will like it.
Sébastien, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That's Sébastien Crozatier, who's a wine merchant for the independent wine retailer, The Sampler. Well, every Friday here on Midori House, we like to go out into our local neighbourhood and meet our neighbouring communities and businesses. Today, we popped about 40 metres down the road to Shriji News Shop, just around the corner from Midori House, and met the local business owner, Sandeep Garg, to hear about his very impressive magazine rack.
My name is Sandeep. I've been running the newsagents since 1982. Me and my brother started the business nearly 30 years ago now. And we've seen a lot of changes in the street. We've tried to create an identity for our own outlet in the sense to differentiate it from other shops that sell similar things by really carrying very interesting magazines and publications that are not available generally through the trade to the consumer. A lot of the titles we carry are because of our links with advertising agencies that we supply, and that is our main business. We carry a lot of titles to do with various fields of interest, from anything to art and design, to photography, to high fashion. And we cater for the locality, so there may be individuals who are looking for something special to read, or for companies in the area who need to source specialist titles that fit in with the work that they do. The shop has actually been around since the war. It's been a small sort of a retail outlet since about 1950, selling variety of sweets and chocolates, the corner shop as they would call it in the old days. Now our primary function is to supply magazines on a delivery basis to people and also to carry a variety of different things. But mainly the target is publications. It tends to be more oriented towards the business people who work in the area. We have a lot of advertising companies, PR companies, fashion houses around the area, and department stores who tend to want a very wide circulation of titles that they can use for their own work, I guess. We also have a lot of international people who live in the area because of the location of the business near Baker Street. You have people who are working in the industry, in banks, etc., who may live in the area, and they want to be able to source titles that they themselves read in their own countries or that they want to try and find out about. Top sellers, it's difficult to say because quite often you will find that one month something sells better than the other. But in terms of regular titles, I guess, on the newspapers, things like the Financial Times and the Times, in the magazines you will have monthlies like probably Vogue, Tatler, some of the car magazines, a lot of the fashion magazines are more sporadic. Sometimes they sell, sometimes they don't sell. And the weekly titles are things like The Economist, Time Out. Monocle is a good seller for us. It's a fairly new magazine, but it sells quite regularly now. I think there's definitely a clear distinction between people who want to access via online, but there is something very, very refreshing about holding something in your hand and looking at it. So yes, I don't think print media is dead by any means. I think it's going to last.
That was our very close neighbour, Sandeep Garg, from Shriji News Shop in Chiltern Street in Marylebone in London. After this short break, we'll be hearing how and why sport has changed the world.
The February issue of Monocle has a warm glow as we look at how charm adds longevity to brands, makes offices great places to work, and keeps people returning to the same restaurants year after year. But there's more.
In the culture section, our man in Tokyo, Kenji Hall, wandered around the corner to Daikanyama's hottest new retail experience, Tsutaya. I jumped on the Eurostar to visit Air, making their new album, La Voyage dans la Lune. And there's four cracking album reviews, more of which you can hear on Monocle 24.
Plus, there's our Japan travel survey, a visit to a jail-turned-craft school in Charleston, a neighbourhood to call home in Stockholm, and a rugged tale from Tehran. The February issue of Monocle is on newsstands now or available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Time now on Midori House for a little bit of music. This is Wouter Hamel and As Long As We Are In Love. And that was Wouter Hamel on Monocle 24. And As Long As We Are In Love. It's 12 minutes before the top of the hour. Now, sport is not normally, I confess, a topic that we go into in great detail here on Monocle 24. But I think we'll make an exception for our next guest. The latest book by the sports journalist Miha Bose, The Spirit of the Game, How Sport Made the Modern World, explores how governments around the globe have come to recognise and exploit the political and social value of sport and events over the past century. Well, I'm very happy to say that Miha joins us live in the studio now to talk about this further. A very warm welcome to you, Miha. What inspired you to write this book?
Well, I've been covering sport a long time, and what fascinated me is how has sport become so important? When I was a kid, you opened the morning paper at the back pages. Now, David Beckham can be on the front page, and Tony Blair could be in Singapore when he was Prime Minister with Cherie Blair, trying to win London the bid for the Olympic Games, which of course succeeded. And what fascinated me is how did sport become so important? Sport was, if you like, a toy room thing, you know. People who played sport was considered a bit sort of funny and, you know, not considered serious enough. And when I looked into it, it was amazing to see how sport really developed about 150 years ago in this country as a concept to build a better human being.
So this, you're saying, arguing, is a quintessentially British thing, a combination of not only competitiveness, but also fair play, and essentially an adult thing, not something for boys, and little boys and girls.
Absolutely. And one of the moments when I thought this book ought to be written was in the metro at Calcutta, which is probably the cleanest place in Calcutta, which is saying a lot, where there were endless repeats of the Premier League. And these were English Premier League matches being played. And I said, why is this appeal? And you looked at it and I went back to Tom Brown's School Days, which is where it started, a fictional book about rugby, the public school in the Midlands in England. And really what he set out to do was to say that if you played sport, you became a better human being. Then a few years later, a French baron called Pierre Courbeton came to this country and he took up this idea and he used it to revive the Olympic Games. And basically what he said was, if nations play sport, then they don't fight each other. And you know, these were two great concepts. One, that sport improves you as a human being, not just makes you a fitter person, but, you know, improves your moral purpose, your moral sense of being. And secondly, that if countries play sport, then they are better countries.
Now, you say that this is an improvement exercise as opposed to just a physical one, but the title of one of your chapters is How Britain Gave the World Two Fs, Football and the F Word. That pretty much contradicts what you've just said, doesn't it?
No, that is what somebody said, that Britain gave the world the two F word. We won't use the other F word. But actually, what I was trying to explain was, because though this was very much a British concept, and Courbeton, who invented the modern Olympics or reinvented the Olympics, recognised that, but actually the British did not go out to spread sport around the world. What I was trying to explain in that chapter is that in a very typical British way, it was done almost as if it was not meant to be done. It happened accidentally. The British would take their football, their cricket, their rugby ball to various parts of the world and would play amongst themselves. And the natives there would see them and be fascinated by it. For instance, in India, cricket started, believe it or not, as a game. Cricket became popular because there were religious teams. There were a Hindu team, a Muslim team, a Parsi team, a European team, a Christian team playing each other. Imagine. You know, imagine religious teams playing each other in cricket and playing quite happily. And that is how it started. So what I'm trying to say there is how the concept of sport was spread, despite the fact that the British didn't really go and tell people, you've got to play our sport. The sport they played for themselves, and others took it up and said, isn't this fascinating?
Now, you're already moving towards the idea of sport being a social divider, because you have it as you know, religious teams playing. A lot of your book goes into the way that governments exploit or benefit from sport in order to further themselves politically. And you really do cover everything from Tsarist Russia to the repression of Catalan nationalism. This was a very comprehensive approach you took to this.
Absolutely, but because I've been covering sport and it struck me as fascinating that government should see sport as, if you like, a point at which a nation feels it has arrived. So Nelson Mandela worked very hard for South Africa to get the World Cup. And when South Africa got the World Cup, he felt that South Africa, this rainbow nation that he had created, had arrived. And President Lula of Brazil cried when Brazil got the Olympic Games, beating Barack Obama's Chicago. Now, that, of course, took some pleasure as well. But nevertheless, the fact that Brazil, which is an emerging world power, if you like, an emerging country, one of the BRIC nations, feels that hosting the Olympic Games gives them that status, means something else. If you look back 100 years ago when Prince Albert held the Great Exhibition, there was no sport there. When countries then, this is more than 100 years ago, wanted to advertise themselves, they had trade fairs. Now who talks about trade fairs? You know, nobody talks about trade fairs. Even London, hosting the Olympics for the only city to host it for three occasions, is using that to promote London. Not that London, you would think, needs much promotion, but the fact that nations feel they are strong, that they have come and made the center stage of the world if they host an important event. I was in China when they had the Olympic Games, and that was described as China's coming out party.
Can that actually be pushed a little bit too far? I'm thinking of recent events between the Brazilian authorities and FIFA, where FIFA came out very openly on Saturday, Sunday, and asked Brazil to stop blocking rules and regulations which need to be passed in order for the World Cup to be staged successfully. And the quote was, you think, you know, just because you've won the World Cup five times doesn't mean that you can sit back and ask for everything. So does a good sporting reputation give a country a bit of an ego problem?
No, I think there, what you've hit the nail on the head is these sporting organisations think of themselves as the Vatican of sport. FIFA thinks that the World Cup is like a state. It doesn't have an army, it doesn't have any government, but because it has the World Cup and because FIFA has given the World Cup to Brazil, it can dictate to Brazil how it is going to stage the World Cup. The Olympics are coming to London. What are we going to get? We're going to get Olympic lanes. If you look at the contract which the Olympic Committee got London to sign when London won the World Olympic Games, it's a very strict contract. It said London had to provide a clean city, meaning that those firms that had not sponsored the Olympics should not be allowed to advertise in the city. Now, if you look at it, those are very strict trade conditions, which if a motor manufacturer were to come in and say to a country, right, we will manufacture a car for you, but these are the conditions, the country would reject. But because sport is so special and because these organizations have the power to give you that special symbol, they can impose those conditions. That is the battle we're seeing in Brazil. We saw in South Africa, they changed the laws whereby somebody who had committed a football offense could be immediately brought to court during the World Cup.
Has a new generation emerged, though? You talked about FIFA just then, the sort of not necessarily just supranationalism, you know, we're bigger than you, you have to dance to our tune, but also of people who think that they are above and beyond the rules. We talked recently about the scandal involving Sepp Blatter, and then we also talk about perhaps recent Pakistani match-fixing scandals where the honour of the game can actually act as a cover for really the dirty underbelly of greed.
Yes, that has been happening, and I think that is where we are seeing a change. If you look at it, the three Pakistani cricketers were brought to justice. The CPS made it clear that they wouldn't let this go, though nobody had actually been cheated, but the game of cricket had been cheated. And what we are witnessing is because the sports organisations have not managed to reform themselves, because the sports organisations have not shown a sense of accountability and a sense of transparency, the governmental organisations, the legislative bodies, the regulatory bodies, the police, are not going to leave them alone. We're seeing this in this country. We're seeing it probably in other countries as well, where they are going to say to the sports organisations, we don't believe you can run your organisations. If you've committed something which is wrong, which is an illegal act, which is an act that falls foul of our regulations and society's rules, then we'll take action. And that is a very, very important and a very necessary change which is now coming about.
So how do you think, we were talking at the beginning of this conversation about the emergence of sport as a way to improve oneself and one's society. And here we are in 2012 having to bring sporting bodies subject to the rule of law. It's a sort of a peak and then a fall.
No, but what we have in sport is when you see a great sporting performance, it uplifts you. You see a Hussein Bolt winning the 100 metres and it makes you feel that, you know, there's a bit of fantasy there. In much of our life, fantasy has been removed. You know, the land of myth and magic has gone. If you have a favourite football team or a favourite cricket team, if it wins, then you feel uplifted. Actually, it might have cost you a lot of money to watch them win. But that feeling, that sense of community that comes, that sense of family bond, if you like, that sense of being together with a lot of people who also look back at how well England felt when they beat Australia last winter. The whole nation was uplifted. You know, that is something that sport can do. Yes, sport has its problems and sports organisations need to learn how to reform themselves. But sport can still uplift people and join people together in a way nothing else can.
Mihir Bose, thank you very much indeed. His book, The Spirit of the Game, How Sport Made the Modern World, is out now. Well, we're out of time for this Friday's edition of Midori House. Today's show is produced by Katie Bilbao, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Andrew Carter. I'll be back in 3 hours' time to bring you the Monocle Daily with Andrew Muller. But from all of us on Midori House, goodbye.